The impact is, as an industry, we can't build real products that people use, because real products that people use do not take only 2 years to build. They take fucking 10 years. It doesn't matter how permissionless, how Turing complete this blockchain thing is. It takes 10 years to build a really good product. And I think that's why, up until now, we haven't seen any real mainstream products in crypto yet. I think it's a big deal. It's a big problem. Neither the investor nor the founder are committed for building a product that can last decades, because both parties can dump their tokens on retail within 2 years.
Welcome to Good Game, a podcast for crypto insiders with your hosts, Imran and Chow. All right, Chow. So I talked about going long on ETH last week. You talked about shorting ETH. And obviously, my trade didn't work out well. But let's talk about how you came to that realization and where we're going to go next.
The crux of the argument for shorting ETH last week, or at least 2 weeks ago when ETH was at like 2,000, was twofold. One is macro was complete shit, and S&P was at a point where you went up so high that it was actually shortable. Okay, so S&P went to 4,200. So that's one part. The other part is basically everyone was bullish on these. The merge was so overhyped that everyone that I talked to was positioned for a pump pre-merge. Which, by the way, is something that reoccurred over and over again in the past, right? Like usually, before a major event, the price of that asset that is going through the event should go up. Okay, so that's something that happens over and over again in the past. But the fact that everyone is so bullish makes me think that there's no more room to go up anymore, right? So that was the crux of the argument for shorting ETH. Right now, ETH is 25-30% down from our last episode. I wouldn't short it now. You should never short like the sort of the tail end of a bear market. Okay. But one thing I'm personally doing on my PA is
Wait, did you just say tail end of the bear market?
I think it's the tail end.
But the armchair economists on Twitter are telling us
well, by tail end, I mean like something like maybe three months until the actual bottom. You don't want to short it in this stage.
Okay.
You definitely don't want to short ETH at this stage or any crypto at this stage. In the 2017 cycle, there were several funds that blew up shorting near the bottom. And those funds were like some of the biggest bulls we've ever seen in this industry. You're so bullish on crypto and yet you try to short near the bottom of the bear market. It's ridiculous. But one thing I would do right now, maybe to hedge your portfolio, is to short S&P. I got lucky. I bought some puts when the VIX was below 20. Now the VIX is like 20, 26, 27, yeah, 25. Five. Okay. I think S&P is still shortable at this stage. And that would be a pretty good hedge.
But I mean, S&P correlates, I mean, crypto correlates with S&P, right? So you could argue that if there's more downside for S&P,
That's exactly why I think that we haven't seen the bottom in crypto yet. I mean, I think there's slightly over a 50% chance that we haven't seen the bottom in crypto yet. But in terms of relative price level, S&P is probably more attractive to short than ETH.
Got it. So you think we have probably a few more months left before we actually bottom. And from then on, up only.
Couple more liquidations than up only.
Oh, Kyle and Sue. cool. This is great. I listen to a lot of great podcasts that are out there, great Twitter threads. But I feel like there wasn't enough diligence on Fei Protocol and the Unwind. Yep. And I think that's really important for our listeners, because there's ramifications of just like what happened with Faye and how it lost a lot of its community members, and it ended up ultimately shutting down. But I believe they also made a lot of governance mistakes that ultimately led to their demise.
So I saw the tweet. Well, I saw one of the tweets about the what's happening with Faye right now, and I thought it was pretty fucked up. But I didn't dig that much deeper, but I know you did. So maybe let's start with some facts, and then maybe we can share some opinions as well.
Yeah. So Faye raised about $1.3 billion in ETH, or $640,000 in ETH, which is pretty insane
from the public sale or something.
From a public sale, it's a way to bootstrap their liquidity or their PCV, which means protocol controlled value. And I'll talk a bit about what that means. But essentially, Faye was designed as a protocol value based stablecoin. And so protocol control value means that ultimately the protocol owns the assets. And so whatever it decides to do with its own assets would accrue value to Faye, the protocol. And the idea for V1 was ultimately to use protocol control value as a way to maintain the peg of the stablecoin. And I'd say 6 months to 8 months down the line, it didn't work out the way it's supposed to. It was very volatile, the stablecoin, Faye. And then V2 was launched, and V2 was ultimately launched as a way to maintain the peg in a much more constructive way, which is ultimately, if I have ETH as a user and I want access to Faye as a stablecoin, I would sell my ETH for Faye. So redeem and mint Faye against the assets. And that turned out to be much better for Faye, I think, in terms of design. And they were doing decently well. And then I'd say this was probably like late 2021, Rari came into the picture and proposed a merger. And this merger, I mean, at the time, it sounded very interesting, which is one, you know, I think the entire community was excited about DAO to DAO mergers.
What was it? If I remember correctly, that might have been the first ever DAO to DAO merger.
That's right. And so, and then maybe we could talk about this afterwards, but like, you know, if you look at like traditional M&A, it's done in a very... it's done very differently, right? Like there's due diligence, there's auditing, there's financial auditing, you know, there's alignment of vision. This was just proposed through a community and people voted on it and then it went through. So what was interesting about this was, you know, they proposed this to the community. It made a lot of sense into, at least at that time, why they did it, which was ultimately you have this like liquidity, you have like this enormous amount of liquidity that's sitting on the balance sheet of Faye. Why don't we use this as a way to bootstrap Rari and their Fuse pools? And Rari Capital and Fuse is ultimately like a tail-end lending protocol. So you could ultimately borrow against tail-end assets that you can't find in your traditional lending markets like Aave and Compound. So, and Faye is looking for demand side. Like they're trying to grow the demand side. And so they thought by marrying these two, it would work. The problem is, and the reason why I brought up auditing was the fact that Rari was already hacked before once. So that was an interesting signal for $11 million. And so when this merger happened, Faye had to pay off all of Rari's liabilities before the merger goes through. And they did. There's actually people that pushed back. So Faye protocol, there's like 10% of the users that tried to vote against it. And instead of like listening to them and trying to figure out a way to listen to their concerns, the team created a rage quit option. And they just said, you know, if you don't believe in this, just redeem against your Faye for dying and get out. And that's what ended up happening. So that went through and they merged.
I mean, on paper, when you acquire or merge with another company, everything on their balance sheet should be on your balance sheet after the merger as well. So that's liabilities in theory should become your liabilities as well. And so you need to pay those.
And it makes a lot of sense to why they did that. So nothing wrong with that, I think. We'll talk a bit more about that. A couple of interesting stats on top is around April 2022, Rari and Faye which is now called TribeDAO, because TribeDAO ultimately manages these two products, was hacked for $80 to $90 million. It was primarily from the RAR refuse pools. And there was a vote out right after that said, let's pay back using protocol control value to the users that were affected. They could have done it easily and they would have been fine afterwards because the market was up only at that point. But it ended up going to shit. Everyone said no. And no one got paid back. And most recently, there was TIP-121, which was announced, which then told the community, hey, we're just going to shut down TribeDAO. And what does that mean? Well, our governance token will mean nothing. Two is we're going to repay back our victims. And that's going to be $57 million Tribe tokens. And finally, what's going to end up happening is the teams are just going to move on to something else. But there, if you read between the lines, what really happened was one, RARI essentially caused the downfall for Faye. Two is, you know, obviously there was huge regulatory risks. Mm-hmm. And then three, you know, the macro change in terms of market. So all of the protocol control value that was worth $2 billion at the peak is worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so finally, you know, if you look at like the way people are getting paid back, hacked victims, probably between 3% and 30% of the dollar they put in are getting paid back. So not every investor or not every hacked victim is 100% getting paid back dollar for dollar. And so now the debate is how should Faye or TribeDAO handle the shutdown of its protocol and how should they handle the community side of things? And it turns out some people are saying that they're advocating more for their investors and allowing their investors to get redeemed back 100% of the money they put in versus the community, which is they're getting like pennies on a dollar, more or less. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are.
What are your thoughts? I have some quick thoughts, but it's not very well informed yet. So I'm curious what you think.
Well, I think Faye was, I think, you know, the founder, Joey, Faye, I think they were on an interesting trajectory without RARI Capital to begin with, which is V2 was interesting where, you know, like instead of like MakerDAO or Aave or Compound, where you over-collateralize your assets and borrow against it to do whatever you want in DeFi, you ultimately sell your assets to the protocol and then you redeem Faye, which is a stablecoin. I thought that was an interesting model. Their V1, not, I wouldn't say V1 was good, but V2 I thought was interesting. And I thought they were on a pretty interesting trajectory.
I thought the current debate of whether to reimburse the community who got hacked versus the investors, I think that debate feels like a tyranny of the majority kind of scenario. And by majority, I mean majority of voting power. Because if you, obviously, like all this on-chain stuff is not, like this is done entirely on-chain. There's no like no link to the traditional legal framework. But if you draw the analogy between Faye and what happened with Three Arrows, right? Three Arrows and Celsius and all the others, all the other lending platforms where the users lost money, the users being the creditors lost money. You could argue that the Faye community that got hacked are the creditors.
That's right.
And the token holders are shareholders. And if you know how capital structure works, typically the creditors have greater seniority over the shareholders. So on paper, I think that the people who got hacked should get reimbursed first. They should have priority over the investors. But the investors in this scenario are the majority of token holders.
You're right. I 100% agree with that, which is the community, the hacked victims should be number one, number two. And the shareholder should be last. And in fact, you know, I have talked to people and investors that are very close to Faye. And there is a group of people within the Faye shareholders community or percentage shareholders that are advocating to pay off the community first. And some people are very vocal about it, like Kobe, right? He said it, like, I think the tweet came out like a week ago or a couple of days ago that said, guys, like, pay the community off. It's goodwill. You don't want to pay the investors off. But from others that I've talked to within that community, there are certain shareholders that are advocating for them to get paid back first, and they're not budging. And I think this comes to like governance, right? Which is, what governance protocol are we following? Are we following, you know, equity shareholders? Are we following token holders? Who has their first right? That's like one. Two is, you're starting to see a lot of decentralization theater in every protocol. And I worry a little bit about this because ultimately, like, whatever the team decides, and maybe the shareholders or the board of directors decide, is what they want for the community. It's not about what the community wants for the protocol. It's what the team and the board of directors want for the community. And if you are a protocol that's decentralized, it should be the other way around, right? But it hasn't been like that for many protocols that I've been a part of.
I mean, I think this is basically a key issue with token governance, right? Like, when everything is going well, when the market is up only, then token governance might be okay. Okay, as long as you don't do decision by committee for every single decision out there, token governance might be okay. It might just work out. But when shit hits the fan, you know, you need the traditional legal framework to take care of scenarios like this. And, you know, I think this is the issue that people, including myself, have actually brought up many, many years ago about token governance. Mm-hmm. It does not protect the minority rights. When something like this happens, it's always going to be a tyranny of the majority kind of scenario. So I think all that to say, we're still very early in the token governance, how we're experimenting with various ways to govern the protocol with token holders.
I don't think there's enough guardrails for startups in crypto at all. What do I mean by that? Here's like an interesting example. Like, Fei had raised $1.3 billion. There was no like rules or, you know, parameters set in place of what they're going to do with that capital. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yep.
And there was no rules or parameters set in place that would allow, like, that would safeguard that those assets were going to be protected, or we're going to be used for certain types of activities. It's just, we're raising $1.3 billion, protocol control value, this new buzzword, and trust us, we will find a way to make sure that we are profitable.
Yep. I mean, this happens in past cycles as well. Like, 2017 was a bunch of examples like this, right? I think what's going to happen in the future is we're going to make mistakes. As a community, as an industry, we're going to make mistakes like this over and over again. And at some point, we're going to learn the lessons and maybe hard code some rules into the protocol, into the token design itself. And, you know, things will just get better slowly but surely. Anyway, I think we've talked enough about Fei. Do you want to switch gears a little bit?
Yeah. And I think this has a lot to do with not enough guardrails for founders. There's some interesting tweets that I've seen recently that talks more about governance and what are the issues of governance in crypto. One example that I saw recently was, you know, I don't remember the name, but NFT, it was an NFT community where one of the CEOs decided that they should get paid seven-figure salary. I mean, like, what the fuck? I mean... That tells you a lot, right, about our industry, which is, and governance. And I totally agree with you. We are very, like, we're on the experimental side, and we're learning as we're doing. And the people that ultimately are going to get affected are the people that are entrusting their capital to these founders. And the founders, I don't think, have enough guardrails put on by investors, because investors are, I mean, there's so many incredible founders that are coming into the space, and I think investors are overwhelmed, capital flushed, and aren't really giving the support that founders need. And so the founders have all this capital, they're young, and they make mistakes. Like, you know, I'm going to go back to the Fei and Rari merger. In theory, it sounded really cool, but did they use an M&A infrastructure or protocol to actually diligence the deal and vote in properly how this deal should be engineered versus let's just vote and let's just move on, right? So I think that we're just very early in how governance is structured. You have a lot of decentralization theater, and then you also have, you know, NFT or founders that are just going to take this capital and do whatever they want.
Yep. Speaking of that NFT story.
Yeah.
What's the latest in the NFT land? I know some of our founders are pretty fascinated by the pseudo swap experiment. What are the facts and what do you think?
Yeah. I think pseudo swap is, you know, very interesting. It's essentially like an AMM like mm-hmm. model. And they have like customizable bonding curves, like linear and exponential curves. So the price based on what is listed for, you can decide how the price should be moving forward. Interesting, a lot of people were bearish on NFT AMMs.
Why is that?
Actually, how do you feel about NFT AMMs?
Well, empirically, it works, right? Empirically, yeah. PseudoSwap is gaining traction. By the way, I'm not entirely sure how much of that can be attributed to the AMM versus 0% royalty, which we can talk about in a bit. Mm-hmm. I think AMMs for NFTs make sense, and it would be pretty similar to the early experiments of AMMs versus central limit order book for fundable tokens, right? Like in the early days, before 2020, before DeFi summer, there were a bunch of off-chain order book, or maybe even some on-chain order book decentralized exchanges for fundable tokens. And yet it was Uniswap that was basically the first breakout decentralized exchange with the AMM model. I think there are pros and cons for both AMMs and order books. The pro for AMM is that it's much easier to bootstrap liquidity with the AMM model. And that can be attributed to, I think, two reasons. One is that basically when you launch a pool, you don't need professional market makers to provide liquidity, right? All you need is to deposit some money into this algorithm, and the algorithm will make markets for you automatically. Recruiting professional market makers is very difficult. Okay, like all these market makers have way too much opportunity cost. They make so much money in other markets. Why would they build something bespoke to trade on AMM, right? That's one problem. The other reason why AMMs are better for bootstrapping liquidity is that I think they are cheaper computationally. So they're much, much cheaper to execute on some of the earlier chains, or all chains in general. But this was a very big deal because Ethereum up until now has been very expensive to use. I think these two factors contributed to the early traction of Uniswap. Now, I still think, so I had this debate with people like back in, you know, 2020 and during the DeFi summer, but I still think that the final destination for decentralized exchanges is order books.
You're a cloud maxi.
I am a cloud maxi. And okay. The problem with that is history is path dependent. Okay, so the final destination may happen 10 years from now when professional market makers are more deeply integrated with blockchains and when blockchains are much cheaper to use. But it'll take a long time to get there. And in the meantime, AMMs are the best thing that we have, are the most pragmatic things that we have. And so I think that's why AMMs are still going to be a very meaningful share of the market in terms of trading volume for the coming years. And by the way, I think Uniswap V3, despite being called an AMM, is actually more like an order book because it provides professional market makers with the flexibility to do algorithms that they want to do rather than using an algorithm that the protocol dictates. And this flexibility is very important for market makers. That's how they can get an edge over the rest of the market participants. If you give them a market making algorithm that they have to use, they have no edge against the rest of the market. And the result of that is, with a very general purpose AMM, there is very little professional market making activity. And without those professional market makers, the spread will be high. But the Uniswap V3 actually attracted a bunch of professional market makers because of the flexibility. So that's one important point to lay out there. The other point is the dichotomy between AMMs and order books, I think, is a false dichotomy. And what I mean by that is, in the ideal world, you should have an order book at the base layer. And then you have multiple AMMs built on top of a central limit order book.
So are you saying layer one AMMs?
No, I'm not saying layer one AMMs. I'm saying, sorry, I shouldn't use the word base layer, but I should have said order books are at a lower abstraction level than AMMs.
Okay.
Order books are more general purpose. They're more quote unquote Turing complete. Mm-hmm. Okay, if you want to think of it from a computer point of view. And the AMMs are more specific. They're less general. They're more specific. And therefore, they are they should, in theory, build on top of something more general purpose, which is the order books. So in the ideal world, you have one pool of order books. And then you have a bunch of AMMs built on top of this one order book.
Why have an AMM to begin with if you have order books?
Precisely because of the fact that AMMs are better at bootstrapping liquidity. You provide this market making algorithm for everyone to use, rather than if you only, in the case of an order book, only the market makers can provide liquidity on the order book. So you sort of increase your initial distribution. You enable more players to participate. I think that's the ideal world. But again, order books are probably a lot more expensive to execute. And that's why we haven't really built this yet. We haven't really had this separation of two layers at this point in time yet.
That makes a lot of sense. And in this case, AMMs are Sudoswap, right? And then Clob, which is central order books, are OpenSea and Magic Eden in this case. It's interesting to see like OpenSea deploy this feature called Make a Collection Offer, which is essentially they're bootstrapping the sell side of the, or sorry, the buy side of the liquidity, right? So anyone can push this button and they could put a mass offering on any NFT that wants to be sold at X price.
With any NFT within the collection?
That's right. So that's very interesting, because before then, like, I didn't have really a buyer of last resort, right? So I have like, I don't know, a bunch of NFTs and I can't sell any of them because there's no liquidity for them.
But basically, up until now, the order book is only sell side. You only have a sell side order book.
That's
right. And with this new feature, they're able to bootstrap a buy side order book.
That's right. And so it's interesting. So you're starting to see like OpenSea become this like pseudo Clob, right? Order, like the central order book that will ultimately help both buyers and sellers transact. I still think it's slower compared to Sudoswap, because Sudoswap, you have liquidity providers that are ultimately proactively bootstrapping liquidity for both buy and sell. So if I want to dump 10 tokens, I can do that pretty seamlessly. Yeah.
It almost feels like the value proposition is similar to this to the sniper in the early days of Gem and Genie, right? It just provides a better user experience for people who want to buy and offer a bunch of NFTs at the same time.
Yeah. Snipers, floor sweeping, I think those are all like interesting features that'll make people, you know, buy more NFTs. Selling wise, like, you can still list all of your NFTs through like the sweeper feature that Gem and Genie offers. But ultimately, you know, they're just considered like more or less aggregators that were acquired by both Uniswap and Who's the other acquisition? Uniswap and OpenSea. That's right. We'll talk a little bit more about that because I think that's super interesting too. But going back to Sudoswap, the analogy I'm hearing about Sudoswap is it's like Uniswap and Copper Launch all for JPEGs is like the theme that I'm hearing. And some of the interesting stats that I started to see as well is so far, the total volume since launch of the AMM, which was probably like less than a month ago, was $30 million in total trading volume, which is interesting.
How much market share is that? Because the entire market went down in terms of trading volume.
I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it was like 10-15% of OpenSea's trading volume.
Very meaningful.
In fact, they've surpassed LooksRare, and I believe X2Y2, which is the other NFT marketplace. This is all without incentives, by the way.
Yeah, and LooksRare used incentives.
A shit ton of incentives. Not only that, they had, I don't know, like every NFT influencer in the world that backed the project publicly, right? Whereas with Sudoswap, like this is what I'd say, like, if you want to know you have product market fit in crypto, launch a product without incentives. That's it. And I think Sudoswap did it.
Yeah. By the way, to that point, like we have a couple founders who build different types of product, you know, AMMs or you know NFT marketplaces or whatever, and they basically tried to copy an existing product with real product market fit, but with a token. And I just tell them, don't do that. You're never going to know if you have real product market fit if you just do that. And most likely, they're not. You're not going to have real product market fit because the product itself is not 10x better without the token. The token at some point will run out of fuel. And your product is gonna be dead.
So I'll name out two protocols that did this really well. DYDX and Arbitrum. I mean, Arbitrum's TVL is skyrocketing and they don't have a token yet. So that's like sticky liquidity, in my opinion. But you know, we'll talk about those later too. But the other interesting, I'd say, philosophical debate came out of Sudoswap is royalty fees. Should creators get paid royalty fees?
By the way, before getting into the moral philosophical argument, how much of the success of Sudoswap do you think can be attributed to the 0% royalty?
Well, it's cheaper for me to buy NFTs on, on Sudoswap.
Yeah.
Right.
What about compared to like X2Y2 and you know the other marketplaces?
Yeah. So here's some interesting like stats, right? So OpenSea charges 2.5% take rate, which is expensive, right? And then you have gas fees, and then you have creator royalty fees, and it all adds up. I remember like I sold an NFT and like I had to pay six figures in fees, which really hurts. And so for me, the value proposition is, you know, circumventing those features or those fees. And then being able to retain more of the value of the NFT.
I think we saw something similar in the Solana ecosystem as well with Yaw. That's Yaw. Right. Which is like 10-15% of the market share of Magic Eden. And by the way, really interesting that in an up-only market, no one cared about, well, I mean, people cared about royalty, but it was not a big deal, right? But when the market is down 80%, all of a sudden, if you lose another 5%, I mean, it's just, it hurts. And
Sir Mi Familia.
It's funny that like this, like features like this are so like dependent on the stage of the market.
Like the true product market fit is finding product market fit in a bear market.
That's right. you're spot on. Right? Yeah.
And so Sudoswap launched at the right time, in my opinion. Some interesting things that are happening. Okay, so Sudoswap, let's just say they're continuing to find success. I saw some cool things that came out of there. There's some NFT communities that are launching their own token side by side with their NFT collection.
Okay.
So similar to like Uniswap. Okay, so if you remember like 2019, 2020, a lot of these new DeFi protocols that wanted to bootstrap their liquidity, couldn't do so before because they wanted like they needed Coinbase or Binance or a lot of these large exchanges to list their token. So they didn't have retail access. With Uniswap, the reason I believe why Uniswap V1, V2 got very successful is the ability to launch tokens quickly and bootstrap liquidity, right? And I think you could say the same for Pseudoswap, right? Like for NFT communities that want to launch their own token and their own NFT, they could just use Pseudoswap. Do you think that statement holds true, or do you think that Uniswap can do better in launching tokens, or any other thoughts behind that?
I'm a little bit skeptical about that view. I don't think OpenSea and Coinbase are in the same category. Like the fact that, you know, back in the day, a lot of fundable tokens weren't on Coinbase. I don't think that's equivalent to OpenSea, because you can still list token, you can still list NFTs on OpenSea pretty easily, right? Like compared to Coinbase, it's a relatively more permissionless marketplace.
Yeah. So OpenSea, you got to have a collection approved, right, by OpenSea. So if I'm, let's say I'm Bored Apes creator, I have to contact OpenSea to create a verified collections page. Once you have that, then you can upload and sell your NFTs.
But what I mean is, like, now, with NFTs, there's less of a securities law issue, which is the case with fundable tokens.
That's right.
Listing on Coinbase, listing a fundable token on Coinbase, it's much less permissionless due to the securities law problem.
Yeah, you're right. You're arguing securities and why it's easier for Uniswap to win shares because Coinbase and other exchanges have to go through this regulatory hurdle
exactly.
Listing tokens. Although Coinbase and Binance went on an interesting tour the past 12 months by listing
tokens. They did. Oh, yeah, back to the philosophical debate, the moral debate about royalty versus no royalty. What do you think? Should creators impose a royalty?
Yes, they should. But it should be aligned with KPIs of the creators and where the creators are taking the community forward. I've seen some NFT communities where the creators dipped and like rugged the users. I've seen some communities that have become zombie communities where you'll see some tweets here and there, but you wouldn't see much expectations from the creator itself. And so I think there should be an alignment of royalty fees, KPIs, that are, you know, more or less decided by the community and the creators so that there is, you know, growth for both sides.
Yep.
Otherwise, I think it's just going to be a shit show.
I think that's exactly right. Like, I don't think this whole argument should be escalated into a moral one. It's not a moral argument. Like, this whole royalty thing is just the contract between the buyer and the seller. It's the contract between the NFT buyer and the NFT creator. As long as it's a contract, the outcome will be taken care of by the market. If as a creator you set too high of a royalty fee, then maybe your buyers will not play the game, and you're not going to be able to make much money off of it. And if you set the royalty too low, there will be players playing the game, but you're not going to be able to make money either, right? So at the end of the day, the market will try to find an equilibrium. And at the end of the day, the market is just a contract between the buyer and the seller. So it's entirely a pragmatic argument, not a moral argument, in my opinion.
So X2Y2, which is the other NFT platform that's doing decently well, they distribute 100% of the revenues to their token holders, which I thought was very interesting. And they just announced a couple of days ago that they're going to allow the community to decide whether or not the creators could get royalty fees. And so they left down the community, but they did make like one-to-one NFTs royalties mandatory. So like if someone creates this like very, you know, like this NFT that's just one of one, then that's mandatory royalty fees. So what's happening is what we're seeing in the XUY2 space, at least, is people are making some collections optional. So if you decide that you want to give creators the fee, you can. You don't have to, like a tip. And I think that's an okay approach. I don't know, I guess, for where we are today. But yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
I think maybe just for our listeners, the cause of all this debate, all this drama around royalty is the fact that NFT creators cannot impose, cannot enforce royalty, right? Due to the design of the NFT standards. And up until now, it's really the marketplaces that sort of impose a royalty. In the ideal world, I think you should be the creator that sets the royalty and then let the market take care of itself. I think that's what should happen in an ideal world.
I agree. I think creators should get the rewards. Well, you have the free riding problem, right? Which is you have these, like you have some creators that don't really are, there aren't incentivized or pressured to do anything. And they'll just continue to earn money while they sit on the couch, right? And so I do worry about making sure creators are incentivized and aligned with the community in a way that's going to be long-term.
I agree with that.
There are some standards that came out, royalty. So there's the NFT standard, EIP-2981, that ultimately allows people to create NFT royalties. And so in the future, you could see people moving to the standard, which I think was created by Recur. And so I think we'll start to see a market shift where standards will probably be used in place. But I think more pressure will need to come from the community to make sure that creators are actually doing their job. Going back to SudaSwap one more time. So you have OpenSea that's very successful, Magic Eden, and let's say now SudaSwap. What can you do with SudaSwap that you cannot do with OpenSea? Like, why is this exciting? Like having on-chain smart contracts that facilitate NFT trading. Why is this? Why does this matter? You know, you can draw examples with Uniswap, where you could talk about composability with other NFT or other DeFi protocols. Yeah, so I'm curious on why SudaSwap and why on-chain versus like OpenSea.
This is a really good question. I haven't thought about this. I've always thought it was the sweeping, the zero royalty, but I haven't thought about the composability part. What have you? What do you think?
I've thought a little bit about it, not enough, but I do think, you know, having, I think it'll bring to the market very liquid and more depth to NFT liquidity, which is great in my opinion. And that can create like much more quicker transactions. So if I want to, I don't know, acquire 20 Bored Apes quickly and then collateralize it on a NFT platform, NFT lending platform, and then borrow against it, I could do that right now. It'll take me, I don't know, a couple of days, weeks, I don't know, to get the right pricing for my assets. So I do think once there's more depth in these pools and the liquidity is right for like, or the pricing is right for NFTs, I do think there could be some interesting transactions that you could do in a way that that would be very capital efficient.
The counter argument to that is I haven't seen many people use their Uniswap position tokens, LP tokens as,
right?
You know, I don't know, collateral to do something else, right? Or as another type of composable position to do something else.
Why do you think that is?
I just don't think it's that useful.
Do you think it's just, you know, bootstrapping the liquidity for the LP side as well? Because I think that's a whole different dilemma as well. And it just gets very convoluted. So yeah, no, totally agreed. What could be cool is if SudaSwap was to get volume, like incredible, let's just say it continues the growth factor here. You could probably create an interesting, like you could create an oracle, right? I think based on the pools that you have, right? With SudaSwap. I think the only NFT oracle that's out right now is by Chainlink. And I'm not sure how the pricing works on it yet. I haven't looked into it.
That's a good point.
I do know Chainlink offers
something. So it would be like an on-chain, fully on-chain oracle.
Yeah. And that could be very interesting to bootstrap other products. So I think we still have a long way to go before we see all this products come into fruition. But I will say I'm pretty excited about Sudoswap. And then the moral dilemma around, you know, 0% fees, I think will get solved over time. You know, it'll have to be in alignment with the community and the creators. Yep. So there was this interesting article that was published by Lauren Stefanian, who is one of the partners at Pantera. And she talked about the optimal token investing strategies that should be done by founders. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a bit about that, or I can kind of give some background?
I mean, I saw the article. I think the takeaway, one of my main takeaways was that the optimal lockup period should be like 6 months or something. And both 0 month lockup and 12 month lockup are less optimal in terms of like impact on the token price. I think that's interesting, but what I'm skeptical about is whether or not that study had enough data points to make this statistically significant. I actually don't know how many data points they have.
I think they also put on the, or Lauren put on the article that, you know, this is based on, you know, minimal data sources. But let's look through it, right? So she also said a couple, they also point out a couple of things, right? One is on average, 15% of tokens from the startup's treasury gets allocated to investors. The average lockup period 2x'd since 2018. And the average lockup now is 2 years. Wow. So you lived in a world, let's say pre-crypto world, where people's lockup periods were
4 years.
10 yeah. years. Well, I mean, yeah, you have 4 years.
Investing and then 10 years to go IPO.
Yeah. And so you have, you know, long-term committed investors. Let's explore this dynamic. So this is pretty exciting because it kind of tells you where the traditional equity space is or the traditional startup space is and where we are in crypto. The traditional startup space, you had found or you had investors that were heavily committed to the success of these founders. So the startup fund sizes were pretty small, like small relative to where we are today. I don't know, let's say $100 million. And I'm just putting that out there. I think probably $100 million was the average, right? And they would make, I don't know, let's say 50 investments. And those 50 investments would come into fruition over a period of 10 years. So over the period of 10 years, the founders in this VC firm, the VC firms would have to give it all they got for over the 10 years so that they could bear the fruit of the IPO once they were successful. And mind you, this percentage of startups that IPO is very, very small in each portfolio. So you may have like 3 to 5 big wins and then the rest are, you know, marked to zero or there's some, like, let's just say they zero out. And now you have startups that are getting, I mean, you have everyone that has $500 million to $1 billion fund, an example. You have startups that are getting investments quickly and they are bringing liquidity to their tokens quickly. And you have lockup periods that are 0 to 2 years. Explain this dynamic to me, Chao.
There's just no long-term commitment from both the founder and the investors.
And what's the impact? Like, what impacts are you seeing?
The impact is, as an industry, we can't build real products that people use because real products that people use do not take only 2 years to build. They take fucking 10 years. It doesn't matter how permissionless, how Turing complete this blockchain thing is. It takes 10 years to build a really good product. And I think that's why, up until now, we haven't seen any real mainstream products in crypto yet. I think it's a big deal. It's a big problem. Neither the investor nor the founder are committed for building a product that can last decades because both parties can dump their tokens on retail within 2 years.
On the investor side, makes a lot of sense, right? Well, where you have ultimately, you know, I'm not saying all investors like this. Let's just say a small percentage of investors.
I think it's a big percentage.
I was trying to be very, nice. Very conservative. I'm being nice. Okay. Let's say a large part of investors are doing this and they know that they're willingly doing this because now they have liquidity. Are investors just here to make money? Like, obviously the name of the game for investors is to be long-term capital partners and to help support founders in the success and the hurdles that they go through over a long period of time. Now you have this interesting dynamic where you have liquidity events that are much more quickly. People are making much more money very quickly. Is there enough incentives for investors to support founders? Because now it seems like every investor is just trying to go after the next.
Basically, that turns investors who are supposed to help founders into active portfolio managers, into liquid market traders, into timing the market. Like it's a huge incentive disalignment.
And that's why we were saying, at least this last cycle, we saw almost every trading firm started investing in venture capital. So we're seeing a convergence between like VCs that are becoming more or less like trading firms, right? Because for them not to take the risk, it's, you know, it's bad on their, let's say...
Almost every VC that I know of also trades the public market. Like they actually have like two, or at least two portfolios to manage. One is the venture portfolio and the other one is the public tokens portfolio. And the skill set to manage both in the traditional world is very different. But in crypto, it's like almost one and the same, which is, you know, timing the market. When do you dump?
So that's a huge mentality change, right? Now you're looking at, you know, you're supposed to invest and believe in the founders for the next 10 years. Instead, you're getting short-term, heavily incentivized events that ultimately creates this disalignment between the long-term future of the project versus long-term future of the investors that are supposed to support them. And I think that's a problem in the space.
It's not only a problem for the investors, even the founders. Like I've talked to, like a couple of weeks ago, one of our founders told us that they think that their tokens are a liability. Think their tokens are like, in the sense that number one, it has implications with respect to securities laws. And number two, the token price going down is a huge distraction for the team and for their community. Like that's only one example. Like this is one founder who told us this precise thing that they think that tokens are liabilities. But I know many other founders are getting distracted all the time by the token price.
The token is the feedback loop from the community. Like that's like it's like a short-term feedback loop from the community that gives them the idea of what the sentiment is for their product or for traction. And for founders to continue to worry about the token price takes away from the product and the product development, which then becomes all about pumpability. Like new news, new partnerships, new acquisitions, which then turns founders into like, I don't know, promoters? I mean, I wouldn't call them promoters, but like...
A lot of these things don't contribute to product building at all, right? Like they don't make your product better product. Like a lot of the marketing and partnerships are entirely superfluous at the beginning, like in the early stage of a product, you know, startup building.
I worry about that because let's say Startup X raises, I don't know, X amount of money. Then they release their token soon after, 6 months later in a bull market, and their token like 20Xs. And now they have $1 billion in their treasury. And let's just say they used, and they sold off the treasury and they have like $1 billion in capital. Now they could use that capital to continue to grow the product and team. What do you think about that?
You know, one of the biggest mistakes I've made in the 2017 cycle was to invest in a few big name projects that raised a shit ton of money and with way too much money on your balance sheet. As a founder, you basically lose all sense of urgency. You just can't ship anymore. I won't name names, but like I made several of these mistakes back in the day. So nowadays, when I talk to founders, oftentimes, you know, if I see that they're trying to raise a lot of money, I will ask them, why are they raising that much money? And by the way, this is one of the reasons why when Faye pitched us, we passed. Like there was no good answer for why they were raising that much money. It's a problem. Like when the founder is too rich, when the company has too big of a balance sheet, there's no more sense of urgency.
I think this all goes back to, you know, governance, supporting, like having the right guardrails, how much capital should be raised by founders, and is there enough guardrails in place to support these founders as they're growing up and building the product? I think that's all very important. There's another effect with the tokens becoming liquid quickly, which is, you mentioned this earlier, which is not enough incentives for the founders. And so we're starting to see like zombie companies, which is the founders got too rich. Yep. And they don't care. They will tweet every day, you know. And this is the same problem with the NFT side, right? With the creator fees, which is, you know, they're not incentivized to work anymore. They have money, they're rich, and they're going to go out and do something else. And I think that's also a very big issue. Look at Airbnb. What did Paul Graham call them? Like cockroaches, right? Like they were able to survive through the bear market of 2008. And they sold fucking cereal boxes to keep the lights on at Airbnb. And now if you look at them, you know, they're synonymous with hotels. And if you don't have that grit, like if you can't build that grit and that resilience early on, then you can't be a worldwide company.
And by the way, when we Alliance went out to raise money towards the end of last year, one investor, I think it was Garrettin, asked us why are you raising only this much money? You could have raised an order of magnitude more money. And our answer was, we don't want that much money. We wanted enough sense of urgency.
That's right.
There's absolutely no need to have too much money and have no plan to use that money.
Okay. You bring up another point, which is VC firms that have, I don't know, $500 million to $4 billion in funds. The problem they run into is that as you raise more capital, for every investment they make, it has to be meaningful for them. So if they don't invest, I don't know, let's say $10 to $20 million in a startup, then they're not going to get the economics that work well for them. So you have this like conundrum, right? Like you have, you know, VC firms that are flush with capital. And you have these startup founders that have never raised money in their world or never managed their own money at that scale that are getting $10 to $20 million. And then you have this whole dislocation of like how the founders are going to use that money in a productive way. And then they, you know, and then the whole system is designed so that the tokens become the central part of the product. And I think crypto founders are losing focus.
I'm really annoyed when investors that co-invest with us, some investors push our startups to launch tokens ASAP, as opposed to building the fucking product. I'm really fucking annoyed.
You know, I think there should be a mandatory 4-year no token. Don't even talk about the token for the first 4 years.
Yeah. By the way, there's obviously exceptions to this just for our listeners. There's several cases where if the token is the product, then you absolutely want to focus your time on the token itself, right? So in the case of play-to-earn games, in the case of stablecoins, right? In the case of, you know, even layer ones where, you know, if you don't have a token, there's no way to incentivize early stakers or miners, right? In these cases, the token is the product. And it makes perfect sense to focus your energy on those things. But in the majority of situations, agreed, it makes no sense.
Even for like gaming and others, like as long as you have the right guardrails, then it's fine, right? But the problem is the industry doesn't have enough standards or guardrails in place that actually protect both the founder, investor, and the community. We're still using SAFE agreements from a decade ago that was pioneered by YC and others. And we're still using that with the token warrant. I mean, it works fine for now, but I don't know if those types of agreements will protect crypto investors and crypto founders and the community at large.
Speaking of games, I was trying to enjoy my weekend and you made me watch this 3-hour podcast between Zuck and Joe Rogan.
It was good. Was it not good?
It was very good.
It was great. I've never heard Mark talk like as who he was. It's always like he's sweating. He looks like shit. I mean, and you don't really get his insights. What'd you think of it?
I was pretty impressed by Zuck. Like, it was the first time I've ever seen Zuck speak like a human being, rather than a robot.
I ordered an Oculus because of that.
Yeah. What do you think? What model did you get?
The Quest 2. As I was listening to him, I'm like, I see the future. And so yeah, I went on to Amazon.
It hasn't arrived yet.
No, it hasn't. You should get one too.
I got one in 2020. I think it was a Rift. By the way, AR, VR, I've been bullish for almost a decade. I made a bunch of angel investments like in 2015. And that was really a long time ago. But a lot of them didn't pan out. I think it was just too early. Some of them did okay, but they didn't actually build real products. They made money through acquisition. Like they were like basically startups getting acquired by giants like Facebook, right? And, you know, 2015, I thought, you know, AR, VR was the future. 2020, I actually bought a Oculus, you know, in the middle of COVID, you know, for remote work, for, you know, connecting with my friends. But I just thought that device was so heavy. Like, there's no way this is the future. And so during that episode between Zuck and Joe Rogan, Zuck actually mentioned that Facebook is working with Ray-Ban to build like AR, VR glasses. That's really cool. And that reminds me of Google Glasses back in the day. I've always thought Google Glasses was going to work because, well, I thought that the concept of, you know, AR, VR glasses was going to work because it's a lot lighter than a huge-ass thing that you put on your head, right? Like an Oculus. And that will just enable a lot of new behavior. Like, I can't work wearing that giant thing. I can't work and keep my head up for, like, hours. I can't walk around. I can't walk outside. And it's very interesting that Zuck is working with a pretty big fashion brand. So they actually want to turn this glasses thing into something fashionable rather than like some nerdy device that only people like you and I use. They want to turn this into something mainstream. So I thought that was pretty interesting. What was your takeaway?
So just touching on Ray-Bans so he talked about like there's two strategies for Facebook, right? One is complete VR, which is immersive experiences, versus augmented experiences where you have glasses where you could see the world and then you have a hologram that's superimposed onto your glasses, right? Through your glasses. And they call this like waveguides. And so they're special type of material instead of glasses that you'd use as a way to see through your lens. And so those are the two worlds. He thinks the two worlds are going to converge over the period of next decade. And we're going to live in a world which I think is called the metaverse, which is ultimately you'll see reality, then you'll also see this augmented computing reality that will give you, you know, much more data or insights around the world that you live in today. And he thinks that's the real world. He said this specifically. He said the world that we live in today, the reality, isn't the real world that we live in today. And we could debate on this if you want. The real world is once computing or augmented reality aligns with us in the physical world. Because right now, he argues that we're all staring at our phones all day to get the data that we need to make a decision. And that's true, right? So like I'll go to, I don't know, Target, and I'll look at the price on Amazon to see what's cheaper, or I'll read the reviews, or I'll see what else is out there that compares to that product. A lot of it is just internet-based searching. Imagine if you wear this glasses that augments the data around me to give me what I think is going to work well. And then if you add like Apple Health, then you could automatically add like data based on my own health on what I can eat, what I can't eat, right? So a lot of that makes a lot of sense. One thing that I got out of this, which I thought was very interesting, is that he said that the next project I'm going to work on is the metaverse. He said that throughout the entire podcast. And he put a timeline on when he thinks this is going to come into fruition. Do you remember that
timeline? I think it's a decade or something.
That's right. Very interesting, because today in the crypto world, we talk about the metaverse if it's already happening or if it's going to happen very soon. But in reality, it's going to take a decade or two before this comes into fruition. What are your thoughts on that?
It feels like the timeline is pretty reasonable. Like I said, 2 years ago, I thought the Oculus that I used was like it was nowhere near mass adoption. What I find interesting is Zuck's core argument for the AR VR is that it's the first type of computing device where you can truly feel that you are in the same room as the other person. And it's a device that is designed from first principles for that very reason. All the devices before, including your PC and your mobile device, are not designed for presence, to feel that the other person is present in the same room. You know, PC was invented for like, I don't know, like calculators or something, and mobile was designed for like calling people. Neither, like if you do, if like you and I are on a Zoom, right? Like let's say you and I are on a Zoom right now through our computer, neither of us feel like we're in the same room, right? So PC is not designed for that. And so that's why Zuck is so excited about AR VR. And he's, more importantly, he's excited about it because up until now, all the things that he worked on, whether it's Facebook or WhatsApp, or Instagram, were things that were already going to take off. Like when they acquired Instagram or WhatsApp, you know, the core user group was small, but they were on a really good trajectory, and there was a very clear final destination for those apps. Whereas in the case of AR VR, it hasn't hockey sticked yet. Like it's still. It's going to take many years of effort to get to that point. So I thought that was pretty interesting, but it's also in line with my personal experience.
You know, in crypto, we talk a lot about the metaverse. What is it going to be? How are we going to interact with it? What would give metaverse... how do we get the metaverse to the entire globe? How do we get this idea, this concept, this world that we live in? Is it through a computing platform? Is it through the attraction of what the metaverse offers? How do we get the metaverse to 8 billion users all over the world?
I thought about the intersection of metaverse and crypto during the podcast. And the part of the podcast that led me to think about this was when Zuck mentioned that in the... like their equivalent of App Store for their AR VR device. Mm-hmm. In the early days, the top downloads were gaming. Which is also in line with what many crypto people think was the first you know mass adopted crypto app was going to be. But over time, gaming was slowly replaced by general purpose. Social apps on their app store. And that made me think about Web3 social. And the thing that came to mind was, I feel like the world of social is going to a place where the amount of computing is going to only get larger and larger. Like we have examples of AR VR, but we also have like examples in TikTok, for instance. TikTok is a very different product from Twitter in the sense that Twitter is mostly based on social graph, right? Like the content you see in your feed is based on the people that you follow. But TikTok is not that. TikTok is based on your interest graph, what you're interested in. And the way TikTok knows what you're interested in is using like really large amount of compute to do artificial intelligence and machine learning on your history of views on other information, other kind of activity or behavior that you demonstrate on their on the app. Okay, so TikTok is really machine learning based, and machine learning requires a huge amount of compute, and it's similar to AR VR, right? Like the amount of graphics to give you the AAA kind of graphical feel, you need a lot of computing power. And crypto is just not there yet. Like right now, we can barely build a Twitter, which is based on social graphs and based on text messages. We can barely build Twitter on crypto, right? Like I've used Farcaster, you've used Farcaster. And you know, I my personal experience is it's not like the experience there is not as good as Twitter yet. And it's certainly the case that not all the information is stored on chain. So the world is going to a place where more and more successful social apps are going to require more compute. And then it becomes a race between the leading social apps and our development in crypto in terms of scalability. Will the scalability of crypto eventually catch up to the advances in social apps? I'm worried about that.
Yeah, I worry about that too. I mean, you have ETH2 that's coming around the corner. You have Solana and other great layer ones that are prioritizing on like, you know, both scalability, transactions, throughput, et cetera. And I'm not sure yet, right? Because, you know, we just battle tested Solana and other layer ones, and now they're refactoring it to improve throughput. You have ETH2 that's coming around the corner that's going to ultimately use layer twos as a way to scale. And then you have like Starkware that started thinking about like layer threes through like recursive
rollups,
layer twos. So with recursive rollups. Thank you. And what's really cool about like that is like, you know, as the project scales, you can continue to scale through rollups. So there are some interesting, you know, ideas that are out there, but I feel like compared to the real world where traction is like exponential, I don't know if we're seeing the same type of growth in terms of innovation.
Yeah. Which leads to Sui and Aptos, which at some point we need to talk about, but not today. But we should probably get the founders of those two projects on our podcast and talk about you know, how they compare to existing, to the incumbents, right? The EVM and the Solana ecosystems.
Yeah, we're probably going to have them on soon. So for listeners, expect Sui and Aptos to talk to us about.
Pretty excited about it.
Same. Well, I think this was a great convo. I think we touched on a lot of interesting trends that we're starting to see in crypto, and just generally some problems that we're going through. Although, like, you know, we're being pretty critical about some of the things that we're talking about. I'm incredibly bullish in the crypto space. I'm excited that all these things are happening now versus later because it gives us the ability to solve it. And that's a lot of things that we're working on within the Alliance.
I mean, ultimately, just follow the developers. And we at Alliance, we're seeing record number of really strong developers and builders applying and joining our industry. So very bullish.
Very bullish. Agreed. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. Catch us in a couple of weeks with our new podcast. Really appreciate the time. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Good Game. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next week.